Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Randy Bachrach for Appellant David Mazet. Your Honor, this ERISA benefit case is unique in a few ways. Mr. Mazet worked in the oil field industry almost all his life in oil production, mostly offshore. At the time of his accident, he was offshore in Angola. And he lost the ability to work in his job. What we're here today about is the disability policy that his employer, Halliburton, provided, whether or not he is entitled to benefits beyond the own occupation two-year period.
Yes, and the specific issue, of course, is whether the abuse of discretion standard of review applies or the de novo standard. And I'd appreciate it if you'd look at this or help us sort this out under the language of the Abbatee case.
I'll certainly try it. Is that how it's pronounced, Abbatee? It was a body. I've always pronounced it a body. Yes, at the threshold, the standard review is key. I have not found, and I am not aware, of any case in any circuit where a plan administrator has completely failed to process an administrative appeal, just totally ignored it, and later was granted discretionary abuse of discretion review by the district court.
Even before we get there, what is the language of the plan in terms of bestowing discretion upon the plan administrator?
None.
It reserves the right language.
Yes, it is the satisfactory proof of loss language.
No, reserves the right proof of loss provision status. Does that satisfy that this is satisfy the unambiguity requirement of discretion?
Not according to this circuit's case in Kearney.
What case?
Kearney. It's cited in the brief, but there's about five or six cases, I believe, that have examined similar language, which basically is referred to as the satisfactory proof of loss language.
Counsel, didn't the party stipulate to de novo review?
Yes, they did, Your Honor. In fact, at the Rule 16 conference, counsel for Hartford stipulated on the record that the plan did not contain discretionary language, and that, therefore, the case would be reviewed de novo.
Now, what happened to that stipulation? Was it brought to the court's attention at the appropriate time when the court was making the decision regarding the standard of review?
Well, that stipulation was entered into the order of the court in the scheduling order, and then it was about a year later when the motions were filed. The plaintiff's motion was titled de novo review.
Right, but did anybody say, wait, hold on, time out. We agreed to de novo review.
Your Honor, that didn't happen until after the remand, unfortunately.
Well, that was just overlooked by everyone in the court, including the judge and even the plaintiff's attorney.
Unfortunately, that's true, Your Honor.
Well,
but the case law says that it is the law of the case once it's entered into the orders.
Well, it's not the law of the case when the case is decided without objection on a discretionary standard.
Well, there was a lot of objection on the discretionary standard, Your Honor, but not based on the stipulation.
The stipulation was never brought up again, as far as I could tell. And it was there was no objection to it until the very end, and it was all over by that time.
Right. But the underlying reason for the stipulation never changed, which is that there is no discretionary language in this plan. The Ninth Circuit case law is clear on that.
Well, what magic language would have to be in a plan for it to be discretionary? I mean, you don't have to have any magic words.
Well, I think it's there are several cases that have addressed that. Basically said it's not hard for a plan administrator to write. We have discretion to determine eligibility for benefits.
Well, you can't use the word so clearly because the state administrators of insurance plans don't like the word discretion. That it's persona non grata in the administrative state plans of administering insurance contracts.
Well, your question was what language
What language would you is necessary besides that they reserve the right to review the proof of loss?
That we have discretion to decide eligibility.
Without using the actual word discretion.
If they don't use the word discretion, how can discretion be conferred without using the word discretion?
Well, there are no magic words, the court has said. However, we have the right to determine eligibility and to to interpret the plan. Those are the words, in effect, that the court has required. And without those words, generally the cases have held that it is not an unambiguous grant of discretion.
So you focus on the words proof satisfactory as being ambiguous enough to defeat the abuse of discretion.
Yes,
standard.
It is ambiguous. The court has ruled that that is ambiguous in prior cases.
Not the exact words. Why shouldn't we distinguish the reserve the right language from prior Ninth Circuit language about proof of loss? I mean, that reserves the right sounds very discretionary to me. I don't know about you.
Well, discretionary to do what is the question?
To decide that the claim is bona fide.
Well, then I would submit, and I believe the Ninth Circuit case law to this point is that that is not sufficient, that is not unambiguous, that it does not put the claimant on notice that that is, in fact, the discretion being retained by the plan administrator, i.e., the discretion to decide eligibility and right to benefits and to interpret the plan, because none of that's in this plan.
So you make a distinction between reserving the right to determine the modicum of proof that's been provided and the reservation of right to determine eligibility for the plan. Is that the distinction you're making?
Correct. This language simply says they have the right to approve the proof of loss, which is a form that is provided by the company to the claimant. That's all that is. It's just a form. And it's filled out by the claimant and the claimant's physician.
The form has been filled out correctly as opposed to whether or not the person is entitled to benefits.
Absolutely.
That's the distinction you're making?
That's the distinction, that there's a proof of loss form that the company provides to the claimant and the claimant's physician. And they have the right to determine whether that form is correctly filled out.
Turning to a little different subject here, on the appeal process here, do you agree that the plan here lacked the deemed denied language that was in Jibian? Jibian, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly.
Jibian and the following case on point, Gatti, which was relied upon by the district court in this case.
Yeah. And this plan did not have any deemed denied language.
It did not state deemed denied. It had time limits.
Well, had time limits, but Jibian, the crucial word was deemed denied.
Right. But more crucial, I would submit, is the fact that under Jibian and Gatti, ultimately, there was a decision rendered. It was late, but there were decisions rendered in both Jibian and Gatti. This case, there was never a decision rendered. Therefore, those cases are instructive, but not dispositive.
Decision rendered initially, but just on appeal, there was no decision, right?
There was never an administrative appeal decision rendered. And under Abati, it seems clear, and I believe that the purpose, the intent of the Abati panel, I understand that one of the judges here is on that panel, so I hope I'm not speaking out of beyond the line here. But it seems like there was a recognition that there might have been some confusion between Jibian and Gatti, and the Abati court specifically said, generally we review de novo where the plan administrator has failed to exercise discretion. If there's no discretion exercised, there's nothing to defer to.
Well, some words that you've missed, because I read Abati, and it said in the rare case, it's something about unusual case. It was not across the board. It had something about only in a rare case it would do that. I didn't see anything so strange or rare about this case.
Actually, in fact, that language.
So when they say the rare case, they say that's the exception to the general rule. That's the way I interpret the word rare.
Well, I would submit that not that totally ignoring an administrative appeal, is rare. It doesn't happen very often. And that language in Abati comes under the heading of what to do when there is a serious procedural administrative error by the plan administrator.
Well, I have to tell you that I was on that panel. And I don't think that was the issue, that when the plan completely fails to, I think you would have a stronger argument the plan didn't act at all. But the plan exercised its discretion, at least in the initial decision. So I'm not sure that.
Well, there was discretion exercised in that.
I mean, there was a decision made. I won't say exercise discretion, but there was a decision made by the company at one point. They didn't just totally ignore the claim altogether.
If I may address the stuff to the merits this case, the sum and substance really boils down to a single number, which is $3,031. That is what Hartford claimed was the earnings potential for several jobs it identified as being readily available to Mr. Mazzette. However, as the plaintiff attempted several times in the district court to present the actual data, the DOL wage data, that the that Hartford claimed it relied upon. And each time, and by the way, that data was submitted in the administrative appeal that was ignored. The 2001 was the most current data. Then, in summary judgment, we submitted the 2002 data to the court. The Hartford's moved to strike that, which was successful. And then later on remand, we submitted 2003 data. That was also disregarded by the court. That was an abuse of discretion. This data was relied upon specifically by Hartford. Their claim file is clear. They used 2001 OAS data, wage data, which they said they estimated and adjusted and extrapolated to 2003. Well, if that was true, then the data should have supported that, the actual data. The actual data shows that that $3,000 approximately apparently was just made up, because it is hundreds of dollars beyond the actual data in terms
below.
Of... Pardon?
You said beyond, or is it below?
This gets a little confusing. I'm sorry. The actual data was actually, for the jobs, was higher.
Right.
You know, a reasonable observer of the testimony of your client could say that your client demonstrated a pattern of over... certain times, anyway, of overestimating his capacity to do jobs, and at other times overemphasizing the disability that he suffered. I mean, there was a definite credibility determination that could easily be made by any administrator or even an administrative judge looking at that.
Well, I believe that when you look at the totality of the administrative record, it doesn't support that.
There's a credibility determination has to be made as to whether or not his claims are reasonable. An observer, the evaluation of the restrictions that the client said he had, and of the treating doctors who seemed to change their position quite a bit.
Well, there were a few changes in the attending physician statements as his condition worsened.
Well, there were suspicious changes because there was a lot of changes, but were not. There was no really documentation that they could put their hands on as to why these changes were made, except his complaints or whatever.
Well, Dr. Armstrong noted in his record why there were certain changes, and he said specifically there was a worsening in his knee, the pain and the swelling in his knee. It is true that he did overstate at times his ability to work. He desperately wanted to go back to work, and in the first year after his accident, he wanted to go back to Halliburton and go back in the oil fields, and he thought he was going to do it. But it worked out for a couple of weeks. He couldn't do it. And there were a couple other times he tried to go work as a truck driver or delivering milk. He couldn't do that. That didn't last. The record is clear that he's limited sedentary work, and he's limited to, according to Dr. Armstrong, part-time sedentary work.
That's his claim. I mean, you know, every
right.
claim has, there's two sides to every story.
But it's important, Your Honor, to note that the physical capacity of analysis is not the issue. The issue really is the so-called earnings potential. Just briefly, I want to address earnings potential. It is totally ambiguous. It is not defined. Hartford has defined it as the median wage for these jobs, but that is, I'm sorry, absurd. It is absurd to think that Mr. Mazzette could go into any job with no skills and earn the median wage right off the bat. That's just not possible.
Well, your time is running. Do I have time for just one more question?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, something which is of some interest to me. Could you explain why the structural, there should have been more testimony on the structural conflict that you say you were prohibited from demonstrating in the claim?
Well, it was mentioned in the complaint, it was mentioned in the motion for summary judgment, and it was mentioned, we brought it up on remand, that the DOL wage data was evidence of the conflict of interest affecting the decision. The judge refused to hear it. Amazingly.
And that affected the discretion of the adjudicator, the conflict.
Yes, it affected the decision. Could I reserve just a couple of seconds for?
Nice try. We'll give you a little time.
Okay. Am I up? Okay. Am I up now?
I said I would give you a little time.
Okay.
You've just about run out of time. But
I noticed
that. Since you got your request in before the last second, why, we'll allow it. We'll hear now from the other side.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Susan Freeman. I represent the Halliburton Long-Term Disability Plan and Hartford Insurance Company. The Hartford plan language did include abusive discretion standard of review language. It said that Hartford reserves the right to determine if or whether the proof of loss is satisfactory.
How is that unambiguously? Unambiguous is the, you know, and that has, that does it to be ring clear. I mean, it sort of, it's up in the air, you know, it's, you could argue that if you were on the other side equally, you could argue both sides of that. So why is it, and the rule is it has to be unambiguous.
Let me make 3 points, Your Honor. The first two from the Abadi case. In the Abadi case, the Court said that discretion means, as commonly understood, the power or right to decide or act according to one's own judgment. And that's precisely what reserves the right to decide if your proof of loss is satisfactory means.
That, it doesn't say you reserve the right to determine if you are eligible for benefits.
Well, I think that's what if your proof of loss is satisfactory to me means. And I would urge the Court to look at footnote 3 of the Abadi case, because in that footnote, the Court points out that there is no magic language and that particular policy was drafted in 1992. And the Court said under the then law of the circuit, the plan in Abadi would be held by any administrator or any insurance company to be sufficient to reserve the power to make determinations on benefits. This policy was a 1998 policy. It was well before Abadi. It was well before Kearney. It was well before all of the decisions that this Court has rendered dealing with this particular issue. And I believe that the footnote in Abadi says, look back to when this was written.
Why don't you put this to sleep? And why don't you just put the whole issue to sleep by putting something in the policy to the effect that the plan administrator has discretionary authority to grant or deny benefits under this plan. You don't have to be a drafting genius to put that in, and you never you left it up in the air. If you would have had that, it would have been unambiguous to me.
Well, Your Honor, I believe you.
You
noted the own point in your questions to my opposing counsel about the concern
you drafted
with the word discretion.
Well, you know, the insurance company drafts the old nut. You know, you drafted it. Contract of adhesion or whatever. You drafted this. He didn't draft it.
But this is, again, a policy from 1998. This is before all of the language, the interpretation in one court after another.
What's wrong with his interpretation that proof of loss is a piece of paper? It's a document.
But it's to determine whether this is satisfactory to me. If, whether your proof of loss is satisfactory, whether you've proved your loss to me, I'm reserving the right to decide whether you've proved your loss to me.
But proof of loss is a different matter than proving you're eligible. Once you've proven you're eligible for disability benefits, then the amount of loss comes into play,
well,
arguably.
Your Honor, when you look at the Kearney decision and some of the others that interpret the words satisfactory and what that means, they say the question is satisfactory to whom? Is this satisfactory to the insurance company? Is this satisfactory to the hypothetical reasonable man? Who is it satisfactory to? There are different ways of interpreting. In this policy, it's I'm reserving the right to determine if, whether this is satisfactory to me.
Well, reserve the right, it seems to me to be the functional equivalent of that the proof must be satisfactory to Sun Life, which we held was not unambiguous. And if you say it has to be satisfactory to Sun Life, well, Sun Life was, I'm not satisfied with this.
That's the closest language to our language. Our language is a little different. It has the weather, the
if. Something here that's the functional equivalent, or maybe not even up to that standard of Sun Life.
Again, Your Honor, I would urge you to go back and look at the Abadi footnote. This is 1998 language. And in 1998, this would have been thought by the insurance company to be sufficient to confer discretion.
Why did the insurance company stipulate to de novo review then?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that was clearly a mistake. It was a mistake in the very early beginning. A mistake at the very beginning. It was a mistake that was never relied upon, never relied upon in any of the briefs. The issue of abuse of discretion versus de novo was thoroughly briefed, was decided. There were numerous motions for reconsideration where this never came up. And besides, you can't stipulate to an issue of law. And this is really an issue of law. What is the appropriate standard of review for the court?
But physically, what happened? Did you just sort of get lost in the proceedings? Because the stipulation was clearly there.
There was the one lawyer who went over to the initial hearing was not the lawyer who handled the case throughout. And she made a mistake.
There's a district court opinion here in one of the districts of in California. Feiberg, I have here. I don't remember exactly. I think it was Hartford Insurance was involved in it. Exact same language as we have here. The district court held that it was not unambiguous. Exact same language that we have here.
And I disagree with that decision, Your Honor, and you're the ones to decide. Let me go further, however, to the point of even if you do determine that de novo review applies, we meet all of the standards on this record because you do have findings that are within the scope of the plan, findings that are clearly supported by the record and are not clearly erroneous by a long shot.
But you had a conflict of interest here, did you not?
We did have a conflict, a structural conflict of interest.
There was a conflict, and didn't the district court, it didn't give full latitude to proofs as to how significant that conflict was in the decision making?
The district court made two rulings in that regard, Your Honor. First, with respect to the underlying decision, the court said, no, you don't have a basis for saying that there is no wholesale and flagrant irregularity. You do have the structural conflict of interest, and there's nothing else to support that that was really a dispositive factor in the underlying decision.
But
later on, there was a remand.
Wasn't the court using the old standard, the Atwood standard, instead of the Abadi standard when it was determined?
Because it was pre-Abadi.
Exactly. So my point, shouldn't we remand it to the district court to apply the Abadi standard instead of the outdated Atwood standard?
No, Your Honor, because there were motions for reconsideration specifically raising Abadi, and the court then determined that applying Abadi, he came to the same conclusion, that, in fact, this was not an abuse of discretion on this record.
But the problem is that the court would not allow all of the evidence on the potential conflict to come in to consider the extent of the
Well, there are two points to that, Your Honor. First, there were two particular pieces of evidence. One, the evidence that was presented at the administrative level, which was a 2001 careerinfo.net report that came up with the proper number for 2001. That was before the court at the administrative appeal level. No, the administrative appeal was not decided. I would urge the court
to
look to the Cushman case that we cited in our supplemental citations. And Cushman says when you have a non-decided administrative appeal, you still apply the abuse of discretion standard. You apply a healthy degree of skepticism. You consider the evidence that was submitted at the administrative level. That's what you on appeal do, but you don't stop having the abuse of discretion standard.
You opened the door on the administrative appeal, and I think that's an Achilles heel for the
Those are the two things that are the errors in this case, no question about it. I don't believe that those change the standard of review. But more importantly, that evidence showed what was the appropriate number for 2001. Later, there was a submission that was outside the administrative record with a number for 2002. The number for 2003 was a number that was excluded by the court, not under an Abadi or abuse of discretion or any of those standards, but because of an evidentiary ruling, because on remand, he had asked, and the parties had briefed, and Mr. Mazzette had agreed that the number 3,103 was the appropriate number.
The stipulation of de novo review.
Well, this was a judicial estoppel determination, Your Honor. This was a, I'm saying he came in and said, I disagree with the 3,103 number because I have 2,003 actual data from OES, and here it is. He came forward with that in a sur response at the very last minute after having debated and argued this for years in the court that you're too late and you already stipulated and said that the 3,103 number was the correct number. Judicial estoppel, I made a decision on what was the scope of remand based upon what you said, and it was that reason that kept out the 2,003 number. That was an appropriate ruling and a ruling that should be reviewed by this court for an abuse of discretion as an evidentiary ruling. So what you have in this record is a man who clearly was able to work, no question about that, was working. And the only question is whether he met his 60% of his pre-disability indexed earnings. You have a determination by Hartford that takes, it, you know, the late January, early February of 2003, takes the only numbers it has, i.e. the 2001 numbers, 2002 weren't done yet, and extrapolates to that and comes up with 3,103 for 2003. If you look at the actual numbers that came in, not for whether or not there was an abuse of discretion, but for determining whether or not there was a structural conflict that really had an impact, as I believe this Court is entitled to do under a body and under Cushman.
Well, you know, there's a lot of credibility here. I myself, if I was adjudicating this, I don't know if I would have bought all of the plaintiff's claims and disabilities. I don't know. But it depends on who's adjudicating this matter. And I'm very concerned that he filed an administrative appeal, and it was never heard from again. And you had time limits here.
The points that were made on the administrative appeal were that the partial disability language that was in a summary plan description should be applied. That was the point on the administrative appeal. That summary plan description was clearly a mistake because it says that. Even it completely eviscerates the any occupation standard. It says if you are able to work but you don't make 60%, then you still get partial benefits.
I don't want to interrupt you on something that's crucial. But once someone doesn't adjudicate administratively an appeal, you don't go into the merits of the appeal. The decision is it's no longer an abuse of discretion because you don't exercise discretion. You're de novo. You do not look into the appeal to see whether or not it would have been successful or not. So my question to you is, if you look at the law dealing with failure to exercise discretion, the answer is only one thing. We go into a de novo review because if you have discretion but do not exercise it, then you don't have discretion.
Your Honor,
and
I would
so we don't want to hear, at least I don't, perhaps my colleagues do, that you would have prevailed on the appeal, because that's, we don't know. I don't know.
Your Honor, I would urge you to look at the Cushman ruling, which I believe is well-reasoned, and what it says is that you look at the underlying decision for abuse of discretion, because that's where discretion was exercised, and with respect to the appeal, you take into account all of the new evidence that was introduced and the arguments made in the appeal, and you can look at that.
Well, that's a district court decision, right?
That's a district court decision. Here, the partial disability A was clearly wrong. There's nothing in the policy itself that says if you don't make 60%, this is how we would calculate your benefits. There's not a way of deciding that. Number two, there was absolutely no evidence that was introduced that Mr. Mazet relied on this summary plan description. And although this Court has not decided the need for reliance, the First, Seventh, and Eleventh Circuits and a number of district courts in this circuit have said you do need to show that you relied on the summary plan description.
Easy if that was the insurance company's position to just rule on the administrative appeal.
It should
and
have.
Make all of those points.
It should have. It didn't. And the third point is, Your Honor, that he does not meet the qualifications for any partial disability because he can earn 60% of his pre-disability income. And that goes right back to the underlying determination. If you look at the new data that he tried to put in, just for purposes of whether or not there was a structural conflict, whether or not it was biased, what you see is that in 2002, starting with your 3,103, which was Hartford's estimated number, the number it came up with. 2002, the OES mean number was 2,923, and the median, 2,804. Pretty close. This SIR response, this last number that they came in with, shows a mean number of 3,002 in terms of actual data and a median number of 2,901. It was really darn close. That small swing shows that there's not really a bias here, a real conflict of interest beyond a mere structural conflict. Hartford was estimating, did come up with its number in good faith. Further, Hartford made its decision based upon not some paper review of other doctors, but looked at his treating doctor. His treating doctor in September of 2002 said, you meet sedentary, light, or medium standard of work. You can qualify for all of those. After Mr. Abadi was reminded of the need to
not
go into
Mr.
only
Abadi.
Any occupation. I'm sorry, Mr. Mezat.
Talking too fast.
Yes,
let me ask you a question to slow you down. Where in the record did the district court say that it would have made the same decision if it were considering the Abadi standard?
We have three determinations and the I believe it is excerpt of record 76.
76?
Yes, 76. Going back to what the court relied on, it looked at the district court's, I'm sorry, it looked at the treating doctor's determination after Mr. Mezat was reminded about going to any occupation. His treating doctor came back with a report that said no change in progress. No further deterioration, no change, but it said now we'll do the only the sedentary or light categories. And Hartford only used sedentary and light categories for determining its 3,103 number.
Well,
it used what he admitted in his administrative appeal he could do.
Do I hear you right that what you're saying that even under a discretionary or a plenary review, it would have been the same. You're
absolutely
saying.
But right.
In other words, you're saying it was harmless error, but it was an error.
Absolutely.
That's the way I read your argument.
Absolutely.
Notwithstanding the fact there was never any correlation with the conflict of interest issue.
I'm sorry. With respect to the conflict of interest issue, there were two determinations on conflict. He said, number one, that there was no evidence that the underlying discretionary determination was biased, was wholesale and flagrant irregularities. He later asked for, directed a remand to take into account the 401k because the policy said that regular monthly pay excludes fringe benefits or extra compensation. Hartford determined that. On that remand, the court said, no, wait a minute. You should have taken into account the W-2s that you had. I believe that you are allowing your structural conflict of interest to be affected. This district court knows when to apply it, when not.
All right, very well. Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
The deputy clerk, please set the clock for 2 minutes. We allowed the other counsel to go over time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, for that. The issue of the 98 policy, Your Honor, that simply is not an issue. They could have amended their policy at any time. And the fact is that they have continuously taken the position that the summary plan description is irrelevant. That's their word for it. The summary plan description is not irrelevant. That is the document, the only document that the claimant was ever provided. And that document contains no discretionary language in it.
Counsel, what's your response to opposing counsel's reliance on the district court's determination that it would not have made a different decision even if it were applying Abadi?
Yes, the district court said that held that Abadi was dicta in terms of Jebion. That is found at document 66, page 3. So I don't really think that.
I think it's 76, wasn't it?
Document 76, page 3. The court said Abadi's description in dicta of Jebion does not overrule Gatti's express limitation of Jebion.
Well, it also talked about Abadi also the conflict of interest on page 4. It talked about the conflict of interest concept as well.
I don't believe the district court ever made any findings or ruling on the conflict of interest. Each time it was brought up, the court basically, as I recall, was of the opinion that, no evidence had been presented. Of course, neglecting, I guess, the fact that we had presented the DOL wage evidence as, conflict evidence. But that evidence was in the record. The main point, again, however, is that the 2003 estimated wage has no support in the record. They have admitted that. And the evidence that we tried to submit over and over again absolutely shows that that figure, 3103, has absolutely no relevance, no bearing whatsoever.
But opposing counsel says that's the figure you agreed to, and you only tried to submit additional evidence too late.
Yeah. The district court made an incorrect finding of fact in a footnote that somehow we had accepted the 3103. We never, ever did that. It would have been impossible to do that because that was the subject of the summary judgment motion that the court had already granted judgment to them on. We could not have waived it. It was already a judgment. What I said in my brief was that the 3103 was sufficient for purposes of the remand only in terms of the time frame.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The case just argued will be submitted for decision.